Whether you're brand new to night photography or you're an experienced shooter, there's a lot of different techniques that we're going to talk about in today's episode to help you to take better night photos. What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Learn Landscape Photography Podcast, or welcome just in general if it's your first time here. I'm really excited you're here. I'm your host, Austin James Jackson, and I'm really excited in today's video that we are talking a little bit about night photography. Now, by the time this episode ships, it is probably about the middle of September. There's still plenty of good night sky, especially Milky Way, to be had here in the end of September and October in the Northern Hemisphere. And I think in today's episode, you're going to learn a lot of tips that you can use in order to help you create those better night photos. So in today's podcast, my conversation is with night photographer Brant Ryder. Now, Brant is just an amazing photographer. I absolutely love his night photos, and he primarily focuses just on astrophotography. But in today's podcast, he's going to share some of his tips, his tricks, his techniques, all that good stuff that I hope that you guys will be able to take away from in order to take better night photos. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Brant Ryder. All right, well, Brant Ryder, really excited. Welcome to the Learn Landscape Photography Podcast. I'm stoked to have a conversation today. Will you just go ahead and start off by telling us about yourself for some of our listeners that might not be familiar?
Yeah, sure thing. Austin, thanks so much for having me. And, I'm just super appreciative of what you do for the photography community. I know in some of the questions, we'll talk a bit about community, but, I appreciate that you give back to the community. And I think that that's a really important part of, photography. So
well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm Brant Ryder. I am a landscape and nightscape photographer based in Colorado. I live out here with my wife and daughter and two dogs. And I thought I'd just try to give you, a little bit of context about my background. As a kid, I always loved exploring the outdoors. I was always curious about nature. And that kind of led me when I was young to want to be an astronaut. And so that kind of was the earliest inclination that I had towards thinking about and dreaming about the stars. Like most of us, though, it doesn't always go the way we plan. Didn't end up as an astronaut, obviously. I am actually a scientist by training, and my day job is as a conservation biologist. And one of the reasons that's relevant for photography is because science and my job is highly analytical. And I got into photography because of the science of photography. And, those of us who do photography know that it can be very formulaic in nature, at least when we're out there capturing images, but there's a creative side to it. And photography for me really unlocked some of that creative side of my brain. What I would say about, my photography and what I hope my photography does is that I really want the work that I put out there to inspire people to protect, the remaining wild places that we have on our planet. And more important, because we're talking about, astrophotography and night sky photography, protect dark skies. So that's a bit about me.
That is a great and a very well thought out answer, I can tell. It is pretty clear when I look at your portfolio that you've spent a lot of nights out shooting, and I'm sure just as many, if not more, days editing as well. And the body of work you have is just incredible. So I want to talk a little bit about both the shooting and the editing aspect in today's podcast. But first and foremost, can you just kind of give us the rundown, maybe the TLDR of just how you generally shoot your night photos? I know this might change depending on the situation, but generally speaking.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think planning is a really important element to all photography, and that's not unique about night photography. So I do spend a lot of time planning, thinking about the locations that I want to shoot, and then trying to scout in the daytime. Trying to find compositions with a flashlight is not easy. So I do try to have that attention to detail, but then there also has to be a pretty significant degree of flexibility in doing night photography. Things never go as planned. And so I try to have that flexibility. So my general approach is, you know, from taking star photos, I will find my composition. I use different, different techniques. So, you know, either stacking star photos or tracking, and we can talk more about that. I use panoramas depending upon the situation, or focus stacking if the composition requires it. Almost all of my photos are what we consider blue hour blends. And I do that because, you know, taking long exposures at night has a lot of unique challenges to it. And so I really like that. I like taking blue hour blends. We can get really clean images. You can shoot at low ISO. And you can oftentimes get a unique angle of light on your foreground, which you can't necessarily get at night when the scene is just lit by stars. So that's a little bit about kind of the general approach that I take to how I take my night photos.
Perfect. I mean, what more could you ask for? You did mention using a star tracker. I'm curious, can you talk about maybe some of the pros and cons to using a star tracker versus what I think a lot of people are doing as kind of the more traditional way at this point, which would be stacking your photos?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I always prefer to use a star tracker. And I know, you know, there's some controversy about star trackers. And I think it's important, before I go into kind of talking about star trackers and pros and cons, I think it's important to note that, you know, there's an element to astrophotography that, you know, it is art, right? And star tracking kind of contributes to that in many ways. A lot of times people see images of the night sky and they say, well, that's not how it looks. And I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, the sensitivity of a sensor and star tracking, you know, brings out resolution in the night sky that we oftentimes can't see. So I think that that's the biggest pro of using a star tracker, is that you can get cleaner images with more detail. You can shoot at lower ISO, right? So you don't get as much noise in the images. And then you can take significantly longer exposures. When you are shooting just stacked images, you're limited to taking shorter exposures depending upon the focal length that you're shooting at. And so that's the primary reason I like to use the star tracker. And I will oftentimes use actually both techniques. So I will track the sky and then I will stack multiple tracked images. So I'll take it a little bit, you know, one step further. The cons of star trackers is, you know, you're carrying extra weight. So if you're going into the backcountry to shoot with a star tracker, that means you have an extra 2-3 pounds in your backpack. You're getting extra foreground motion. And so because you're tracking the night sky, the foreground moves, and then you're having to blend images. And so it requires, you know, skill and technique for doing the post-processing, that blending. And then there's a learning curve to, you know, setting up a tracker and, you know, getting your tracker aligned on Polaris and that. And so I guess that's kind of a bit about the pros and cons. And but I do, it is my preference to use a star tracker.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you there. And after doing a lot of workshops where I'm bringing trackers, I want to underline the fact that you said there's a bit of a learning curve to use it, because when you first go out to use it, it's unlikely that you're going to have a great degree of success and set it up in 30 seconds. You're going to spend a lot of time setting it up, and it's frustrating for a lot of people, because like if you're using a star tracker and you bump it even the slightest bit, it's now out of alignment. So totally redo your alignment. And obviously there's some trackers that are better than others. I'm curious, do you have any tracker that you recommend or a tracker that you like using?
I mean, I think that there's a handful of, the primary brands that people use. You know, Star Adventurer, the iOptron are both really, really good value for the money. One of the things that I don't like about either of those is that they are kind of unwieldy in their shape and very difficult to pack into a backpack if you're going into the backcountry.
Yeah, they're terrible.
And then obviously, you know, lots of folks are starting to use the Benro Polaris. The tracker I use is a lesser known brand. It's a Vixen Polari. And the reason I actually chose it is because it is a small rectangle and it's heavy and it's bomb proof and you can drop it and it's easy to pack because it's square and rectangular. So it fits into your bag in a way that you know, that's easy to pack gear around. Whereas those other brands are not as easy to pack. One thing I will say about the Polari is that, you know, it doesn't come with a polar scope, so you have to get a separate polar scope. But for wide field astrophotography, you know, you can even use it without a polar scope. It has a kind of rudimentary polar scope, but not one that allows you to, you know, really fine tune your alignment. So anyway, that's the brand I use and why I use it.
And I know you also, or at least I think you also use an astro modified camera. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain to some of our listeners exactly what that means and why that'd be advantageous for someone to astro modify their camera?
Yeah. I mean, I am also a big believer. I oftentimes proselytize the value of astro modified cameras. You know, most people will be aware that, you know, all cameras obviously have a series of filters. Those filters basically allow them to capture the visible spectrum of light and also filter out harmful spectra of light that might damage the sensor, things like infrared. And so what astro modification does is it pulls off some of those filters that come on your camera and adds a filter that increases the sensitivity of the camera to certain spectra of light. And so, you know, the spectra that are most common in the night sky in objects like nebula is H alpha. And that's the most common astro modification is people who put this H alpha filter on their camera. H alpha is a red spectrum of light. It's, you know, not to get into the details, but I am a scientist. So 656 nanometers is the spectra. And the AstroMod, that H alpha filter, increases the sensitivity to that light spectra. And so it allows you to capture it in a way that you can't capture on a regular camera. The other thing that's kind of nice about astro modification is it allows for about, and I could get this wrong, so, you know, nobody quote me on this, but I think it's about a quarter stop more light that you effectively get. And so, you know, at night, the more light you can get to your sensor, the better. And so by removing those filters and bringing in a little bit more light, then you're able to, you know, capture better images, cleaner images. And, you know, obviously in low light situations, that's really important.
And that astro modified camera is something that you cannot do in post-processing. Is that correct? Like you can't just add more red saturation?
I mean, you can do some of that in post-processing, but you're never going to get the same type of images that you can get from an astro modified camera. And I think it's important that it brings out the true colors of the night sky. That's not to say that there aren't significant post-processing challenges with dealing with astro modified cameras. So we can talk about, you know, that more in a couple minutes, but yeah, I think, it's tough to do. You can try to recreate it in post, but I haven't seen anybody do it to the extent that you can get with the astro mod.
Yeah. And once you astro modify a camera, like you're not using that for regular landscapes, right? Like that's now just a nighttime camera.
Yeah. So, you know, there are filters that you can put on lens filters and on sensor filters that you can put back on the camera to be able to use it for daytime photography. But, you know, it's just kind of a pain in the butt, and I don't do it. I have two bodies. I have my AstroMod body and my regular body, and I use the regular for all of my foregrounds and, you know, standard landscape photography. And then the AstroMod is, you know, the focus on just the astro stuff. So
is there any other essential gear that you like using for your night photography that someone may not think about?
Yeah.
That's fine. Answers no.
Yeah, no. I think that there's a lot of things that people don't think about, and none of this is essential. Well, the first thing I'm going to mention, one of the things I'm going to mention is essential, but I think a comfortable camera bag, this is true, right, in general for landscape photography. Like, you're going to be carrying 30 to 50 pounds of gear. Like, you want something that you're comfortable carrying that's going to help you, you know, get from point A to point B. So I think a really good camera gear, it's also going to protect your gear. You're out there oftentimes far from your car. You never know what the elements are going to bring. So camera bag is my first piece of essential gear. You need a tripod, right? Obviously, to take long exposure photos, got to have a tripod. And when people ask me about tripods, I'm a firm believer that like buy once, cry once mentality, like get a good tripod. Don't get something cheap because what it'll end up happening is you'll have to replace it in, you know, 2 years when it breaks and the leg falls off and then you can't take your photos. Prime lenses, you can do astrophotography with zoom lenses, but I think prime lenses are one of the tools that it's expensive, but obviously it's going to up the game in terms of astrophotography. I'm a Sony shooter, and so Sony historically didn't have an intervalometer built into the camera. So, you know, having an intervalometer that you can set your camera for long exposures, and I think you shoot Sony as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Sony caps out in at 30 seconds, and then you can put it into bulb mode, but then you have to use the intervalometer to take longer exposures. So I think that's an important piece. And then, you know, I'm a firm believer in safety, and anyone who goes out there at night knows that, you know, anything can happen. So a good headlamp is super, super important. A backup flashlight is really important because you don't want to be 5 miles from your car and having to use your iPhone flashlight. Always tell people like have a Garmin inReach, be prepared to have something that could help you get out of a sticky situation, and you could get help if you needed it. So
I want to take a break from today's episode and talk about a really cool opportunity if you are a beginner or intermediate photographer that is really serious about taking better photos and getting better at photography. Now, usually about 4 to 6 times a year, I teach in-person workshops around the Western United States centered around helping you become a better photographer. Now, my workshops are kept to just 5 people, which means that you will get plenty of one-on-one attention. So regardless of your skill level, whether you just picked up your first camera or whether you've been shooting for 15 years, I promise you, you're going to get so much out of it. I'm going to cater the class directly to you. Best of all, after the workshop, I'm going to add you to my alumni group on Facebook where you can get literally weekly image feedback. We can connect at all times. When the workshop is over, it's not done. I'm still going to be your mentor. I'm going to be there to help you and become better at photography. Now, like I said, if you're serious about becoming better at photography, don't wait any longer. Register for one of my workshops this year. You can visit austinjamesjackson.com/workshops. That link will be down below in the podcast description that you can click on as well. I really can't wait to see you guys out there. I want to talk a little bit about some composition stuff as well, because I think a lot of people struggle to find compelling compositions at night. Do you have any advice for someone that maybe is in that boat?
Yeah. I mean, I think this goes back to the planning piece, right? Like scouting. You're not going to get amazing night photos without putting some forethought into what you're shooting and trying to find unique compositions. You know, again, you're not going to find those by happenstance. You're going to go out there, you're going to have a vision of what you want to shoot, but then you're going to have to spend some time finding it, and doing that during the day when you can see, I think, is really, really important. Using, you know, general photography compositional rules, all of those things apply, you know, to night photography. Rule of thirds, leading lines, symmetry, balance in your images. I think that those are all important. Of course, there are going to be unique elements that you need to consider in night photography. So if you are, for example, taking your foreground exposures at night, you have to remember that you're going to be taking very long exposures, and any subtle movement in the foreground is going to create blur, and you're going to have a hard time getting a sharp image. So that's something that I would tell people to consider. Always consider kind of the scale of the Milky Way and what focal length you're shooting the scale of the Milky Way at. And if you are blending images, making sure you're shooting your foreground so that you have enough of the sky in the image so that you can, if you're blending in your Milky Way, you have space for it and you're not going to be trying to juggle that in post-processing. And then I think the last thing I would say, and this is actually something I learned from another photographer, is when you're taking blue hour, photography in general is a kind of a golden rule is side light is amazing. You know, directional light isn't as good as side light. And so thinking about the directionality of light on your foreground is really, really an important, you know, feature, I think, for night photography. So I use that oftentimes in my blue hour. I think, okay, here's my blue hour foreground. Where's the light going to be coming in, you know, from the rising or the setting sun, so that I can get some of that nice soft light on the foreground from the side.
So tell me this, and I know this is another question where it's fine if the answer is no, but do you think you need to think differently when finding compositions at night versus during the day? And if, like, how so, if yes?
I mean, I think you have to be extra cautious at night. I think oftentimes people go out and think, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's really easy. In the culture of Instagram, scroll and like, people don't oftentimes know how much goes into any single image. And that's, you know, planning, time spent shooting, and then time spent post-processing. And I think with night photography, that's even more true than with landscape photography and daytime photography. So putting in that extra caution, that extra planning, you know, being out in the wilderness, and far from a trailhead can be dangerous. You can fall, there's wildlife to contend with. And that's not to make night photography scary, but it's just to tell people that you need to be careful and you need to, think about what you're doing. Like, always tell somebody where you're going, when you're going to be expected back. You have to be comfortable kind of like being out there and alone with your own thoughts. Like, I do most of my photography by myself. And so that means like I'm hiking in the dark for 1 to 2 hours by myself. Then I'm out there for 2 to 3, 4 hours by myself. And then I'm hiking back. And so that's a lot of time by yourself. And I think just that mental state is different than it is for daytime photography. And then I think obviously there's the editing and post-processing stuff, which, you know, we could spend hours just talking about those things. But you obviously are going to have to take a very different approach to how you capture your image, and then how you're going to edit that image in post-processing, especially if you're tracking skies and you're blending it with, you know, blue hour foregrounds. So I guess the last thing I would say about that is, having said all of that, and I think this is true, I'd be interested to hear what you say about this. And I know I've talked to other astrophotographers about this. Like, there's something about being under the night sky that gives me this incredible humbleness and sense of my tiny, insignificant scale in the universe. And that's frightening, I think, for a lot of people. But I thrive on that. That's what makes me feel alive. And that's part of why I do night photography. And so that's part of that mindset about how I think about shooting night photography and what kind of drives me back to it, as opposed to just going out and shooting a sunrise or a sunset. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense to me. I mean, I would definitely agree with you there. I don't have anything to add. I mean, you covered so much, so that totally makes sense to me. I did want to talk, though, about one photo that you posted recently. It was a star trail image. You know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It was probably only like 4 or 5 days ago. Yeah. But I know a lot of people probably know how to shoot star trails. But what I think a lot of people don't know is how to do the effect that you have where your stars are colorful. Yeah. And I think a lot of people think that the photos like this are fake, but they're actually more real than when the stars are white. And I think I know how it's done. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I know how it's done, but will you share how you can do that? Or are you willing to share that information?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the funny thing about this question and that image is that and this is true, I think, for photographers in general, like, I'm rarely happy with the work that I do. And we can talk more about this in a bit, but like, I'm my own worst critic. And that was only the second star trail image I have ever done in my life. And so I learned so much from taking that image. But we could talk more about that here. I think the common misconception, as you said, like, people think stars are white, and that's actually true. There are some white stars, But there's so much natural variation in this, the color of the stars, you know, that includes blue stars, it includes white stars, it includes yellow stars, orange stars, red stars. And maybe this is common sense to a lot of people, but like, I actually didn't know this before I started looking at people's star tarot images that had that color variation in it. That variation is directly tied to the surface temperature of the star. So blue stars are much cooler. The surface temperature is much cooler. And then a red star is obviously very, very hot. And so that's intrinsic in the images we take of the night sky, that stars have that variation in color. A bit about how to do it. So you would need to use an intervalometer. Obviously focusing on the stars is, you know, pretty important. And then you're going to basically take short exposures. The length of the exposure is going to be dictated by the focal length of your camera. So let's just say you're shooting a 24 millimeter lens. You're probably going to take, you know, 10 to 13 second exposures. I tend to err on the side of shorter exposures so I don't get any star trailing. Although in this case, you do want some of that star trailing, so star trailing is okay. So you maybe might even go up to 30 second exposures, and then you're going to set a short interval between photos, and you're going to set your intervalometer to take hundreds and hundreds of photos to capture those photos over 3 to 7 hours. In order to get that intrinsic color variation, you're going to want to shoot at a lower ISO than you would shoot the Milky Way at, for example. So I think in that photo, I can't remember exactly, it was either like ISO 1250 or ISO 1600, something on the lower side. Whereas, you know, you traditionally think of, if you're shooting single images, Milky Way photography more on like the 3200, 6400 type of ISO. And then you're going to point your camera in the direction of the sky that you're interested in. And that's obviously going to dictate the pattern of trails that you get. So for that image, I was pointing north at Polaris, and that's what's going to give you that circumpolar, that circular pattern in the star trails that you saw in my photo. And then the post-processing piece of that is obviously bringing it into software, and there are, I think, lots of different star stacking or star trail stacking software. But basically, the software is going to make it very easy. It's going to bring all of your images together, and then it's going to put it's going to overlay them, that's going to give you those trails. And many of the software pieces also have gap filling algorithms, so that if you did have too long of an interval between the two exposures that you take, it can help fill those gaps. So, I mean, that's a bit about kind of how I shot that image. What I learned from that experience is that I didn't shoot enough exposures to get like really smooth star trails. I think it was about 2.5 hours of exposures for that photo. And I think from, you know, me going forward, I'll probably shoot more like 5 or 6 to make sure I can really get that smooth look on the trails. So.
And the reason why you lower that ISO, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is so that essentially when you see all the stars are white, you've more or less blown out the stars. So by having that low ISO, you're not blowing out the stars and maintaining that color. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And I mean, going back to, you know, we were talking about the star tracker, like one of the nice things that a star tracker enables you to do from that same perspective is that you're taking longer exposures, but you can shoot at lower ISO. So you are able to capture that natural color variation in the nebula and the, you know, color of the star. So, just kind of circling back to the star tracker piece for a sec there.
Yeah. Will you give us, I know this is not really the focus of this episode, but I always like to ask people, what's the basic rundown of how you edit your photos, what software you use? Give us as little or as much as you want.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I suspect most people know this, although maybe not. As much, if not more, time goes into actually editing, especially Milky Way photos and star trail photos, than than goes into the actual capturing of the exposure. So that's an important thing to highlight. I'm a bit crazy about editing my photos. And so I will oftentimes take, you know, as long as 5 hours sometimes on a single photo. But my average is about 2.5 hours per photo. So a lot of time goes into it. The first piece of at least the astrophotography element is editing the sky files. Because I use tracked images and I oftentimes stack them, I will use a program called Starry Landscape Stacker. I'm a Mac user. So most of the software I'm going to highlight are Mac programs.
For PC, I think they have similar, that's called Sequator, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. So there's, like I was going to say, there's PC equivalents to pretty much everything I'll highlight. So I'll take multiple tracked images. I oftentimes shoot about 2 minute exposures, and I normally stack 2 to 3 images. So that's the first thing I'll do. And I'll use Starry Landscape Stacker to do that. Once I've stacked my sky images, I will do some basic adjustments on those images. And I often, I never get the exposure exactly how I like it in the field. So I'll tweak exposure, I'll do some tweaking on the contrast, the blacks, the whites, and then an essential step, which I think a lot of astrophotographers do is I do something called a star reduction. So, you know, obviously there's, you know, when you capture tracked images of the night sky, you have, you know, massive numbers of stars. And I find those stars and the size of those stars oftentimes to be just subtly distracting. And I want the viewer to really focus on the Milky Way and not on this massive star field around the Milky Way. And so star reduction is a technique that basically just draws the viewer's eye to the Milky Way and reduces the size of the stars so that they're a little bit less distracting. So that's kind of always the first steps that I use. I typically do those raw edits in Lightroom and sometimes in Photoshop. On the foregrounds, I do a lot of my raw editing. I'm a Lightroom and Photoshop user, so I use both. And I don't, you know, depending upon the day or the mood or just kind of how I'm feeling, depends on whether or not I'll do the raw edits in Lightroom or in Photoshop. But you know, anyone who has seen my images knows that I love flowers and stars. And one of the tools that I oftentimes use to do that is focus stacking. And so basically what I'm doing is I'm taking multiple exposures to create greater depth of field in my images. And then you have to deal with that in post-processing because you've got, you know, a focal point very close to you on a flower and then all the way back to a set of mountains in the background. And so oftentimes when I'm building those night images, I'll have to do that focus stacking before I actually blend the exposures. So I use a program called Helicon to do that. And you can do the same thing in Photoshop by basically bringing the images in, aligning them, and then using masking to paint in the areas that are in focus. It's just more time consuming. And I did that for years before I found out about Helicon. So, okay. So now we've got the foreground set. We've got the starry sky, the Milky Way image pretty much set. This is where I transition almost strictly into Photoshop. And the next step is obviously blending the sky and foreground image. So blending the images, you know, it can be as easy as just using the quick select tool. If the foreground horizon line isn't complex, like it's just a, you know, it's just a mountain range that's not overly complex, the quick select tool does pretty good. So I'll use the quick select tool, and then the real editing of the photo begins. So the sky and the foreground are together. I regularly use an add-in called Astro Panel. I use that primarily for color correcting. We were talking about the Astro Mod camera. So if you were to take a picture during the day with an Astro modified camera, it would look just totally pink. And so obviously the color balance of the sky image, because of the filter that's on the red spectrum filter that's on the camera, you have to correct that color balance in post-processing. And so Astro Panel, just, you can do it, you know, yourself with the white balance slider and with the hue slider and saturation slider and that stuff. But again, I've found that Astro Panel makes that a little bit easier. It also has some star reduction features. I don't use those. It also has features about, allows you to dynamic stretch the image, which brings out some of the nebulosity and color of the night sky. The other software I use in every single photo, and anyone who spends a lot of time editing images, uses luminosity masking. So there's a add-in called Raya Pro. But there's a bunch of other, panels out there that people can use for doing luminosity masking. It's useful for selecting certain parts of the image that you want to then do color dodging on or dodging and burning on. And so I oftentimes use a mid-tones luminosity mask, and then I'll do a lot of the color work and the dodging and burning on those layers. Sometimes I will use, light bleeds are a common feature in, landscape photos. And sometimes I'll use light bleeds. I don't do a lot of, I know some night photographers like the dreamy kind of, atmospheric glow in images that Orton effects give you, but I do not typically use that. Let's see, the last thing I use, and I know this is a lot of different software, is I use the Nik Collection sometimes. Nik Collection is a tool, add-in set of panels that was created by Google, and I think DxO owns it now. But it's just got a handful of things, like a tonal contrast adjustment thing that I use sometimes. It has some color features that I think can be useful for bringing in a little bit of additional, nice tone to the image. Boy, I know that was a lot. I think that's kind of the majority of things.
That is great. I made a few notes here that I'll link down below to some stuff that you mentioned. And I'm curious also, obviously you're shooting a lot of blue hour and tracked where noise isn't going to be a huge issue. But if you're not doing this, there's obviously a lot of people shooting images that have very noisy night images. Do you use any plugins or external software, or you have any hacks to reduce noise really well? Sure.
Yeah. Like you said, it's not something that I like worry a ton about. And it's part of the reason I typically like blue hour blends. Obviously you're going to be able to get clean foregrounds at low ISO when you shoot during blue hour. But what I will say is that, we talked a bit about my obsession, with wildflowers. And one of the things that's true with trying to shoot wildflowers, I mean, there's all these memes out there about photographers trying to go out and shoot wildflowers, and you leave your house and there's not even, the leaves are not moving. There's no wind at all. But then as soon as you get there to shoot your flowers, it's like gale force winds and the flowers are moving all over the place. And obviously that makes it nearly impossible to focus stack images, because aligning the images is impossible. So oftentimes when I'm shooting flower foregrounds, even during blue hour, I will bump the ISO way, way up so that I can get faster shutter speeds. And then I'm dealing with high ISO images, which do have noise in them. And I have to deal with that. I think the most common software that I have used, but now this is not a dig on this software, but I have not had a lot of great luck with it, is Topaz. I think a lot of folks do use it. But I haven't had great luck with it. another technique that is a very common technique if you want to stay very, very true to single exposure or just stacked images, is if you take long exposure foregrounds, you know, like, so let's say 2 to 3 minute foregrounds at like f2.8, then you can stack those images and use like median blending in Photoshop. That's a tool that I did used to use. I don't use anymore. But then I guess the most important thing with noise reduction, and anyone who doesn't know about this trick, like Lightroom has introduced, like, an AI has obviously changed a lot of the way we edit images, and the AI algorithm, noise reduction algorithm in Lightroom, is just mind-bogglingly good. So for those of you who have not checked it out, in the develop panel, it's located, it's called Denoise, and, you know, it can take a noisy image and basically eradicate the noise in the image. And so, you know, back to the flower thing, that's actually what I use now for cleaning up those flower images before I do the stacking. And again, what kind of AI wizardry is in the background there that enables it to denoise images the way it does, I do not know, but it's revolutionary. And I suspect Topaz uses something similar.
Yeah, they definitely do. I actually, funny that we're talking about this today, because I actually just released a YouTube video today where I tested like the 6 most commonly used noise reduction software specifically for Milky Way photography, which include like DxO, and include both the Topaz, it includes Lightroom and all that. So it was really interesting to make that video and kind of see what works and what doesn't. Kind of funny that we're talking about that today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super curious, like, was there like a clear winner, or do you not want to give it away and just tell people they got to watch the video?
No, I mean, I'll tell people, because if they've already made it this far on the podcast, they've made it a long ways. So, it was actually really close. I would say personally, I think the Topaz and the Topaz Photo AI, not Denoise, Photo AI, and DxO's Pure Raw 3 both provided really good results. They were slightly different, but they were both equally as good. Everything else was a little bit worse. Lightroom was all right, but Lightroom has this tendency, if you really try and do a severe denoise, of like, it starts to make your stars look like you're taking a photo of a campfire where there's sparks coming out almost. Okay. Like the stars kind of do a weird little thing. But Lightroom, I think I said this in the video, Lightroom does like an 80 to 90% of the job that the other software is doing. If you already own Lightroom, it's free, versus if you buy Pure Raw, it's $130, and if you buy Photo AI, it's $200. So if you don't care to have the absolute best, it's probably not worth spending the money. But if you do want the absolute best, I did find those two to be the best. But you can check out the video and look at the comparison and how I compared everything. But it was really interesting to do, because I expected those two to be the best. But the other softwares were, like, there were some that were really not good. Like, I tested, like, On One No Noise was not good. Luminar Neo was no good. It was interesting. But anyways,
that's cool. I'd be curious to see how they perform with foreground images as well. I suspect they would be, you know, you'd get similar results. I mean, one of the things you said resonates with me, and that is that, you know, oftentimes when people start out in photography, they're just like, well, you know, I should just crank the sliders way up. And, you know, that's true. That's not the best approach with any of those denoise things. You're going to get really crunchy looking images. And so you just got to use everything in moderation, I guess, is my advice typically.
Absolutely.
But I've never tried the Lightroom one on my star images. And I mean, I'll be honest, like, and maybe this is giving something away, like, I don't denoise any of my sky images, in part because, like I said, I'm taking 2 minute exposures and then stacking multiple exposures. So they tend to be pretty much noise free. So yeah, I mean, it's good.
Yeah. That is definitely the benefit of buying the star tracker and learning how to use it, because you can take, I mean, ISO 200, 400, 800 images with a moderately affordable camera that's not the best full frame on the market and still get low noise images, which you would not be able to do without the tracker. So that is the benefit of the tracker if you don't have the top of the line body as well. But I know you just gave us some great advice there. The last question that I do always ask people on the podcast here, so if you had one piece of advice for a photographer that's trying to improve, get better at photography, what would it be? This might be a piece of advice or something you'd tell your past self, or just some words of wisdom. What, you have anything for us here?
Oh my gosh, so much advice, probably too much advice for photographers. And I try to live by some of this advice. I'll be honest with you, that photography is not an easy thing to do. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to photographers, both on, you know, through social media and locally, in a community setting. And I think a lot of photographers suffer from, the imposter syndrome and being very critical of our own work and never feeling like it's good enough. And so my first piece of advice, and probably the most important piece of advice, is just enjoy the process of capturing photos. Remind yourself why you're out there doing it. You're out there because you love being outdoors. You're out there because you love, you know, capturing the world and showing people the world through your lens. So I think that's a fundamental piece of advice that I think we can all continually remind ourselves about. My second piece of advice is don't get static. You know, let yourself always be open to learning new techniques, always wanting to improve and hone your craft. And then, you know, this circles back to something I said earlier in the podcast. Don't be stingy with your knowledge and your passion about photography. Like, I am a firm believer that, like, we should share the knowledge that we have. And honestly, my wife gets on me about this, but, like, I'll spend hours answering people's questions in DMs on Instagram, and to a fault, you know, I mean, I probably shouldn't give out as much advice as I do for free, but everybody starts somewhere and everybody learns from other people's work. And so let's build a community. Let's share that with other folks. So that's my second piece of advice. And my third piece of advice draws directly from that, which is, you know, find a community of photographers and shoot with those people, because you will learn an immense amount from those people and the way they do things. Everybody has, you know, subtly different things. Living here in Colorado, we have a pretty good community of photographers. Most of them are younger than me, but they tolerate hanging out with the old guy. So I go out there and I shoot with people and I learn from people. And I think that's great advice. And the next piece of advice is, and I think this is a really important one in the day and age that we're in, is that don't let social media dictate your self-worth or how you feel about your art. You know, the famous quote is comparison is the thief of joy. And that in a social media world where there are lots of other people out there posting incredible images, so many talented photographers, it's so easy for you to get down on yourself about your work and about what you're capable of. But if you heed that piece of advice where you're always learning, always reminding yourself why you do it, and that you're not doing it, you know, for a like, but you're doing it because you enjoy the craft, that's really, really important. Next piece of advice is try to stay true to yourself. You know, I mean, it's your art and it's the world viewed through your lens, and you should be able to make it how you want to make it. Don't let somebody else say to you, oh, well, you know, it should have been this way or it should have been that way, because you're the artist. And so that's a really important, I think, piece of advice. And then the next and last thing is just don't be afraid to fail, right? You're always going to fail in life in general, but you're always going to fail in photography. And I think if you asked any photographer this question, they would tell you the same thing, and that is that you're going to learn more from your failures than you are from your successes. And that by going out there and just practicing, you're going to fail a lot, right? You're going to take horrible exposures. You're going to, you're going to say, oh, well, that didn't work, or here's what I learned from this. I mean, just talking about the star trail image, like I learned more from that, my failures in that image, than the successes in that image. And so I think those are kind of my key pieces of advice to photographers, either people just getting into the craft or people who've been doing it a long time, but feel paralyzed by not being able to edit images. And we all go through that. I think of photography as a roller coaster, right? We have incredible highs and we have substantial lows. And when you're in those lows, you need to just remind yourself that there will be a high again. You're going to have images that you create that you are truly proud of. And then you're going to have images that you're like, all right, well, maybe this didn't go exactly as I planned, but what can I learn from it? So yeah, so that's my advice for people, either new or experts out there doing photography.
That's great. So much good advice there. Like, rewind your podcast, listen to that twice. There's so much good stuff. Will you just finally finish us off here by telling us where we can find more of your work? If you have tutorials, classes, anything like that, give us the whole nine yards here.
Yeah, sure. I wish I could say I had tutorials, and I wish I could say I did workshops. Again, if I had a dime for every time people asked me if I did it, I probably would be rich and I wouldn't have to do the workshops at all. But yeah, I still think about that, you know, as somebody who does this in a very freelance capacity and not as a full-time job, and wanting to spend as much time with my kid when she's growing up. That's the biggest reason I haven't started on the workshop thing. I do think eventually I'll get there and I'll do it. So the primary way you can engage with my work is obviously through social media. My Instagram page, Brent Ryder Photography. I do have a website, and that is www.elementalearthimages.com. I do have a print store, which is I've been working on slowly over the past couple of years. So, you know, if people go out there and like my work, pretty much all of my images are available as prints. I primarily do metal and acrylic. It's fine art landscape photography. So, going back to like, this takes a lot of time and energy to put into, like, yeah, the images are not cheap, but I think, again, it's fine art. So, keep that in mind. And then I'm on Threads, of course. And, I've actually recently, based on the advice from another photographer, because everybody wants to get their images out there and in front of people, because it's a medium with which we can get feedback on our work. I've started posting actually to Facebook more and in photography groups on Facebook. And I will say that, you know, there is an algorithm on Facebook, but it's an opportunity to get your images in front of a lot of people, get some good and bad feedback from people on your work. So those are the kind of the primary ways to engage in me as an artist and where my work is.
Well, perfect. Thank you so much for being here. This is such a great episode. I think there's so much good stuff. I mean, I feel like I say that every episode. Everyone that comes on is just so great, especially here. I mean, there's so much good information for anyone, whether you're a night photographer and want to get better at night photography, or you just want to get better at photography in general. I think there's a lot of great information. So thank you so incredibly much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you. Truly an honor, and I appreciate what you do again. So thanks again.
Well, that is one long episode, but so much good information is packed into there. If you have the time, go back, listen to this one again. I think you'll find that you're going to learn a lot more things that you maybe didn't pick up on the first time. I mean, there's just so many tips and techniques and tricks that Brant gives us in order to help us to take better photos. And I really, really hope that it was helpful for you guys. So if you like this episode, let me know by leaving a subscribe to the podcast and a review. Reviews are so helpful for me to continue to grow this podcast. I'm so appreciative for everyone listening to the podcast. It's really grown a lot in the past couple of months. So thank you so much for listening and for being here. We will see you guys next time on the Learn Landscape Photography podcast. You guys have a good one. Bye-bye.